My name is Gary Strait, and this is Straight from the Road. People are all the time asking me if I'm related to George Strait. And the answer is no. I don't look like him, act like him, walk like him, or talk like him. And I darn sure can't sing like him. But I have written a few country tunes, and that's what part of this story is about. That and a tale about a rock and rolling road trip from Key West, Florida to Prudhoe Bay, Alaska, and a 1953 Peterbilt motorhome. Blue moons, which are two full moons in 1 month, only occur every 2.7 years. June 30th was a blue moon and also my 41st birthday, so that was as good a day as any to pack up and leave Lakeland, Florida. During the two-month layover at my brother's house, I'd spent the meager remains of my life savings and a good share of any future income transforming the interior of the antique Peterbilt into a motorhome, studio, and Harley garage. So far, my adventure in Zelda the Pete had taken me from Colorado to Florida, but after 2 months in my former hometown, I was feeling restless and claustrophobic and was anxious as hell to get back out on the road. I said goodbye to my brother Robin and his wife Joan and rolled out of their driveway under a bright, moonlit summer sky. Before I got to the highway, I turned in the parking lot of a country music nightclub to check my fuel tank. During the renovation of Zelda the Pete, the one detail that I'd continued to neglect was fixing the fuel gauge. I was dipping a yardstick into Zelda's fuel tank when the manager of the nightclub walked up. "You're here a little early, aren't you?" he said. "I wasn't expecting you till next Thursday." "I'm not sure what you're talking about," I replied. "Ain't you playing here next week?" "No, I just pulled off the road to check my fuel." "Oh, hell, I thought you was next week's entertainment." "No, I'm not an entertainer," I said. "Damn, that's a relief. I couldn't afford a singer driving a rolling Taj Mahal like this." "Want to see inside?" I asked. "Hell yeah, come on, boys." He and several bouncers that had gathered around climbed inside Zelda. I fired up my homegrown sound system and plugged in one of my demo tapes. "Who's that singing?" the manager asked. "Me." "I thought you said you wasn't an entertainer." "I'm not," I said. "The biggest crowd I've ever played for was a room full of third graders out in Colorado. I'm not an entertainer, I'm a writer." One of the bouncers picked up a tape and read the name. "Gary Strait. Hey, are you any kin to George?" "Nope, I don't even spell my name the same." "I kind of like this tape. Can I get one?" I was taking money from the bouncer when the manager noticed that a crowd of onlookers had gathered around Zelda trying to get a glimpse inside. "You're in the wrong business, mister," he said. "Instead of selling tapes, you ought to be charging admission. 50 cents a head, you'd make a killing." I gave the crowd a 50-cent tour for free, then sold them some tapes. I eagerly stuffed the cash into my pocket, but the manager's words kept ringing in my ear. "You're in the wrong business, mister. Instead of selling tapes, you ought to be charging admission." I pulled onto the interstate and headed towards Daytona Beach. Daytona had been one of my favorite stomping grounds during my misspent youth, and I was thinking that a night on the beach would be a perfect place to initiate Zelda the Pete on her maiden voyage. Back in the 70s, my buddies and I partied all night long on the beach and often woke up to the rising sun with sand in our shorts and a fire in our bellies. Or was that a fire in our shorts and sand in our bellies? One morning I woke up, my best friend was practicing his snorkeling technique on my girlfriend. Even though it was the era of free love, the price tag was a little more than I could handle. But he eventually got the short end of the deal. He married her. Paybacks or hell. In those days, the only people that were concerned about what we did on the beach all night were the fathers of teenage girls. Unfortunately, now everyone seems concerned about who sleeps on the beach, and there was a sign every 50 feet to remind me that I wasn't welcome after dark. I think it was Thomas Wolfe that said, "You can never go home." He didn't mention that I couldn't go back to Daytona Beach either. I parked Zelda at a Walmart parking lot and went to bed. The next day, I looked up an old biker buddy that had just moved back to Daytona after living in Colorado for several years. When I arrived at their house, there was a loaded U-Haul truck sitting in their driveway, which I took to be a bad sign. Steve was a Jerry Garcia look-alike, and one glimpse of his bushy hair and salt-and-pepper beard said, "Scooter trash." Steve spent most of his time tinkering with motorcycles or cameras, but he and his wife, Lori, were also accomplished scuba divers, so I asked them if they wanted to run down to West Palm Beach and do some diving. Lori opted to stay home, but Steve had his scuba gear loaded up in Zelda before the last words of our conversation echoed off the empty garage walls. As a rule, it's a good idea to have reservations on a dive boat, especially on a holiday weekend like the upcoming 4th of July. We lucked out and found a new charter service that wasn't booked, so we had the whole boat to ourselves. As we cruised down the intercoastal waterway, then out into the Atlantic Ocean, I discovered that I had a lot in common with the boat's skipper. Captain Dan was a salty dog who looked like a human tugboat, with a neck as thick as a bridge piling and arms like a longshoreman. He had been a trucker in his former life, and oddly enough, he had also spent time as a wedding photographer. According to Captain Dan, owning a dive boat wasn't much different than owning a truck. "The cost of fuel is high," he said, "and permits and insurance are outrageous, and the price of a damn boat is out of this world. If the payments don't drown you, the regulations will. Of course, once you get past all the BS and get out here on the water, there's nothing in the world I'd rather do. Get some fresh air in my face and listen to that big old diesel engine whine while I watch the world drift by. Come to think of it, it's just like driving a truck." As far as being a wedding photographer, he added, "You aren't photographing their face, you're taking a picture of their ego, and that, my friend, can be a very risky business." The first morning out, the water in the Atlantic Ocean was 80 degrees and calm enough to water ski on. I hadn't been diving in over 6 years, so I was preoccupied with trying to remember all the do's and don'ts of diving. Strapping on 80 pounds of dive gear and jumping out of a perfectly good boat can be intimidating if you're out of practice. They say diving is like riding a bicycle. You never forget how, but I've never heard of anyone drowning on a bicycle. Our first dive was down to 60 feet, and I was huffing and puffing like a 50-year-old linebacker while sucking my air tank dry. Fortunately, the second dive was on a shallow coral reef, so I was able to relax, and we stayed down nearly an hour without risk of getting the bends. I did, however, become nauseated from breathing so much compressed air and swallowing too much salt water on top of the ham and cheese sandwich that I'd had for lunch. About 50 minutes into the dive, I started puking my guts out. I motioned to Steve that I was surfacing, and I began my ascent. I was having difficulty removing the regulator from my mouth and barfing, then shoving the regulator back in, gasping for another breath, all the while making sure that I exhaled enough air to avoid rupturing my lungs. I managed to reach the surface without drowning, choking, or retching up my lungs, but I was still engaged in some pretty serious projectile vomiting. Evidently, recycled ham and cheese sandwiches are a delicacy among barracudas, and I was serving up a seafood buffet that wouldn't quit, so I had plenty of company swarming around as I bobbed up and down in the waves. Getting through these types of minor challenges without serious incidents has a calming effect on me. Therefore, the second day diving, I was totally at ease while we drifted along the coral reef with the sea turtles, angelfish, grouper, and the occasional barracuda. Many divers are environmentally conscious, and it's not that unusual to see them collecting trash off the reefs and disposing of it later on shore. Steve had an assortment of garbage that he was cradling in his arm, and I didn't think anything about it when he reached into a small depression and pulled out a square green package. We surfaced, and Steve asked me what I thought the package was. I didn't have a clue and wasn't that interested until he said, "Think about it." Then it hit me. It's a common practice for drug smugglers to fly over in airplanes and drop packages into the water at predetermined sites to be recovered later. However, sometimes the packages are never found. When I realized what Steve might be holding, I broke into a sweat even though I was up to my armpits in water. Nearly everyone that I went to school with in the 60s and 70s had experimented with marijuana. I did, but I never inhaled. And I can assure you that the only foreign object that has ever entered my nostrils was at a greasy finger sparing a savage blow. Hey, Aqualung. However, I must confess that I was intrigued by the adventure of Steve's find. We got to the shore and threw our gear in Zelda. Even though there wasn't a soul on the dock, I felt like a million eyes were on us. I stood lookout while Steve inspected the package. "Well," I raised my eyebrows. "Either it's what you think it is, or someone went to a hell of a lot of trouble to ship a couple of pounds of baking soda." "Jesus, Jones," I said. I felt my bowels loosen. "What do we do now?" "Hell, I don't know," Steve said. "What's it worth?" Beats me, bunch more than I've got. My dismal financial picture flashed through my mind, and I couldn't help but entertain the obvious question. Can we sell it? My words sounded as though they were coming from someone else. I don't know, he said. Where? Let's go to the bar and talk this over. Having become a potential felon was the only thing that had squelched my appetite in the last 40 years. I tried to hunker down on something called a tugboat burger, but all I could think about was the incriminating package lying in Zelda. I felt as greasy as the cheeseburger. Damn, this goes against everything I believe in, I whispered. But I sure could use some cash. What would you do with it? Well, for starters, I could pay for this stupid trip. What about you? Oh, I think I'd open a scooter shop, Steve said. He was staring at the window as though he could see the reflection of a row of Harleys. I looked at all of the lowlifes in the bar that wouldn't give a second thought to selling the dope. Had I become one of them by a mere twist of fate? Drug Smuggler Blues was playing on the jukebox. I closed my eyes and found myself sitting in a scene from Miami Vice. Any minute, Crockett and Tubbs would come squealing into the parking lot in an old Cadillac convertible, then burst through the door with 44s drawn. I could just see myself spending the night in the Broward County Jail. I chuckled at the unbelievable image, but then I pictured my nieces and nephews snorting a line of coke, and I found no humor in that. Suddenly, I was disgusted with myself for even considering the options. That stuff's going to end up some kid's nose, I said. I'll be damned if I want anything to do with that. I say we ditch it. Steve hesitated, then he shrugged in resigned agreement. We downed our beers and walked out into blinding sunlight. Steve grabbed the package, cut it open, and shook the contents into a nearby dumpster. The rats living in the dumpster might party all night long, but I'd be sleeping with a clear conscience. 2 days of scuba diving had taken its toll on my finances, besides the money I'd spent stocking Zelda with food and fuel. I counted what I had left, which was a mere $673.42. How in the heck was I going to get to Alaska on that? I got out the map and estimated the miles down to Key West. It was at least another 250 miles. 250 miles divided by 10 miles per gallon. That's 25 gallons times $1.35. I closed my eyes and was calculating the figures on the backside of my eyelids. That's 33 bucks and change times 2, 67 bucks. It's going to cost me 10% of my net worth just to drive that damn truck down to the Keys. I opened my eyes and squinted at the sun. What the hell am I going to do? I don't know, Steve shrugged, unconcerned. Why do you want to drive all the way down there anyway? Because it's there, I said. Because it's the end of the road. I surveyed the dock, relieved that I had ended the world's shortest drug smuggling career. I guess I could save a couple of bucks and just head north from here. Nobody'd know the difference, Steve said. Nobody but me. I loaned Steve my Harley and he headed north toward Daytona. I pulled my life savings from my pocket again and counted it one more time. There was still only $673.42. Then I thought about the expensive commodity that we'd left scattered in the trash. Damn. If you repeatedly say you're going to do something, you'd better at least give it a good try. I couldn't give up my Key West to Prudhoe Bay adventure before I even got started, so I climbed in Zelda and pointed her south. Just before I got on the freeway, I was sitting at a traffic light when a black BMW with tinted windows rolled to a stop beside me. The blacked-out window slid down to reveal a hot-looking blonde in her 20s. She leaned out of the window and scanned the length of Zelda. "Hey, dude, that thing's awesome," she said. "Hauling anything interesting?" "Nothing too exciting," I said, but I was thinking about the green package. Her male companion stabbed a button on the console, and her face disappeared behind the tinted window. Something told me that I could have struck a deal with the blonde and the Beamer, but the package was gone, and so was she. I don't know if it was the heat, or the blonde and the Beamer, or the thought of my dismal financial outlook, but somehow I managed to miss the Florida Turnpike and ended up on a two-lane city street in downtown Miami during rush hour. Eventually, I reached Highway 1, which skips across the Florida Keys like a rock skipping across a pond. First, there was Key Largo, then Plantation Key, Upper Matacumba Key, Lower Matacumba Key, Long Key, Duck Key, and No Name Key. The islands were interspersed with mildew-encrusted mobile homes as well as million-dollar mansions, and both were camouflaged behind mangrove trees and palms. The roadside was reminiscent of the early days of automobile tourism. Tacky fluorescent signs hawking souvenir stands that sold t-shirts and live bait. Makeshift plywood signs tempted travelers with images of enormous trophy fish caught on charter boats with names like Atlantis, Bottom Fisher, and Scooby-Doo. Other signs boasted discounts on diving charters to the coral reefs around the Pinacamp Reserve. Most of the dive boats are called cattle boats because they pack people on board like cattle being shipped to slaughter. The signs did little to convince me to join the fun. I scanned the roadsides on the less populated keys looking for a place to park for the night. Years ago, you could park anywhere, but now the palm trees are outnumbered by no parking signs. It was well after dark when I opted to take up residence in the Jolly Roger campground on Grassy Key. The manager escorted Zelda through the park, and heads were popping out of tents to see why the trash truck was coming through at 10:30 p.m. The manager did his best to guide me into a parking space next to the boardwalk, which ran right along the waterfront. I respectfully followed his directions on the first two tries and nearly backed into the Gulf of Mexico. The third time, I pretended to watch his directions while I backed Zelda into place. A crowd of onlookers had gathered around, and I gave them all the 50-cent tour of Zelda for free. I popped in a Jimmy Buffett tape and demonstrated the homegrown sound system. Then someone picked up one of my demo tapes and asked about it. "Gary Strait," he read aloud. "You any kin to..." "No." I was getting sick of answering that question, but I popped the tape in the deck, and pretty soon $5 and $10 bills started coming out of the happy camper's pockets. Suddenly, my net worth had increased by nearly $100, and I was becoming a happy camper, too. I told my fellow travelers about my plans to drive from Key West to Prudhoe Bay, and like most everyone else, no one had even heard of Prudhoe Bay, Alaska. Key West is often referred to as the end of the road. I assured them that Prudhoe Bay was the other end of the road, at which point several of them volunteered to be co-pilots, cooks, or mechanics. We sat on the boardwalk and threw down a few beers while two retirees from Valdosta, Georgia, entertained us with some tall fish tales. Hank and Gilbert had come to the Keys for a fishing vacation, but the fishing hadn't been that great. However, the entertainment at the boat ramp was stellar. There had been several camper and boat combinations that jackknifed into the concrete wall while angry spouses stood by helplessly, waving their hands and shouting directions. "Turn this way! No, damn it! The other way! The other way!" One seasoned fisherman had effortlessly guided his boat into the water like a true professional, only to return from the parking lot to find his boat slowly sinking. He had neglected to put the drain plug in. Another angler raced up the ramp without locking the winch on his trailer, and his $20,000 bass boat slid off onto the concrete ramp. Several folks advised me not to take Zelda the rest of the way down to Key West because there simply wasn't enough room to maneuver through the tiny streets. The crowd of campers finally broke up around midnight and I went to bed. But I bolted awake at 5 the next morning, and my first thought was, there's no way in hell I was going to come this far and not drive the last 50 miles. I could just hear myself telling about my trip across the continent. "Yep, I drove Zelda the Pete from one end of the continent to the other. Well, all except the first 50 miles. Just before sunup, I fired up Zelda and quietly eased out of the park. I enjoy getting out on the road before dawn, and that morning was no exception. The iridescent orange glow of the rising sun backlit the palm trees and fishing piers, while 1,000 points of light sparkled on the rippling water. One of the most distinctive aspects of driving down to the Keys is crossing the long bridges that connect the islands. I was in the middle of one of those long bridges when a light show of a different sort lit up Zelda's interior. I knew this was the morning of the 4th of July, but I thought it was a little unusual to start off the day with fireworks. It was a pretty cool display, except for the fact that the sparks were coming from under Zelda's dash. I quickly flipped off all the switches, including the ignition, but the heavy brass switch for the marker lights had shorted out and welded itself in the on position. I envisioned all of my dreams going up in flames right there in the middle of the bridge, surrounded by water. Fortunately, there was no other traffic on the two-lane bridge, so I coasted to a stop, then reached under the dash and jerked the smoldering wires loose. The immediate danger appeared to be over, and I wasn't going to rewire the dash out in the middle of the bridge, so I cranked Zelda up and drove on into Key West. I crept through the tiny streets looking for a 272 square foot of unoccupied ground that didn't have a no parking sign posted. I parked next to a commercial fishery hoping that Zelda would pass for a delivery truck. I unloaded my mountain bike and set out to explore the many side streets. Key West is a beautiful old town rich in history. The architecture is strongly influenced by the early European explorers, merchants, and missionaries. Statuesque Victorian homes with two-story porches and lace woodwork stood shoulder to shoulder with the Spanish-style stone fortresses. And judging from some of the bizarre sculptures and psychedelic paint schemes, I'd say that most of the contemporary architecture was influenced by people who were under the influence of drugs. Two of Key West's most noted residents are Jimmy Buffett and the late Ernest Hemingway. My heart is in the country, but I listen to all kinds of music, and my tape case is chock full of Jimmy Buffett tapes. Jimmy is a storyteller who built a multimillion-dollar empire out of simple three-chord songs about his experiences as a down-and-out pirate and sailor. The Calypso Cowboy has musical roots that take him back through Nashville, where he had his first commercial success with an album called A White Sport Coat and a Pink Crustacean. The title cut to that album was a parody of the Marty Robbins hit A White Sport Coat and a Pink Carnation, but his most recognizable tune describes a mythological place called Margaritaville. Ernest Hemingway lived in Key West for 12 years, although he is still one of the island's most noted residents, and Key West was the setting for his novel To Have and Have Not. Hemingway was an adventurer, and he altered the course of literature with his simple prose about callous men and hard women and their tormented relationships. I took a tour of Papa Hemingway's house and studio. The tour guide rambled on as my mind created a black-and-white movie version of the private life and times of the man called Papa. I could see the passionate lovemaking in the bedroom that overlooked the garden, but I also saw the drunken rampages on the nights that he stumbled home from Sloppy Joe's bar. After the tour, I sat on a bench under the window of Hemingway's studio. I closed my eyes and took a deep breath, while trying to absorb the energy of the great writer. But all I felt was the sweat that trickled down my forehead. Years ago, a lady friend and I took personality tests in an effort to gain some insight into what career paths might best suit us. I discovered that my personality bore many similarities to Papa Hemingway. On one hand, that was encouraging. On the other hand, it was troublesome. Like Hemingway, I crave adventure, and I like to spin yarns about my experiences, but how many demons did we share? Hemingway had many lovers, but he lived a lonely, tortured life filled with drunken isolation and depression, and he chose to end it by sucking the shell out of a 12-gauge shotgun. By the way, as far as the lady that I was dating when I took the personality test, I discovered that her personality most resembled that of Leona Helmsley. I left Hemingway's house and did some more exploring on my bicycle. The sweat and exercise helped clear my mind. I enjoyed soaking up the sun and the scenery, but I couldn't overlook the people who had escaped to the end of the road and found themselves hanging at the end of their rope. Hundreds of dreamers flocked to these tiny islands, searching for the illusion of freedom and hoping that the magic of Buffett or Hemingway would rub off on them. I found several of those lost souls sleeping in the street. One young man was sprawled across some wooden steps. A bottle lay near his hand, and he had pissed his pants. I wondered if he had came to town with a guitar or a typewriter. Dreams can become nightmares, and anyone who dares to dream must be willing to wake up and recognize the difference. Nightfall on the 4th of July would bring a hotbed of partying, but I wasn't in the mood for indulging my vices. I had an overwhelming urge just to get on with my adventure, but I still hadn't driven Zelda the Pete to the end of the road, which meant I had to drive through the historic district to the southernmost point of the island where Highway 1 begins. As I eased Zelda through the crowded, narrow streets, the 4th of July partiers danced around, waving and pumping their fists wildly in the air, signaling for me to blow Zelda's air horn. Zelda had accidentally become a one-float parade. Then there were the brooding artistic types who glared from the shadows of their psychedelic houses. I find it interesting that people who choose alternative lifestyles get defensive when they think others are judging them. However, they don't hesitate to judge you with condescending stares. I guess they only approve of ruckus behavior when it's their own brand. Cruising around in an antique truck was just the sort of thing Hemingway might have done. Papa enjoyed touring in large luxury automobiles, and Jimmy Buffett likes to explore the Caribbean in his Grumman Albatross. The antique aircraft is hardly the choice among recreational pilots, but Jimmy loves flying his monstrous seaplane just for the fun of it. I rounded the corner where Highway 1 originates and took a picture of Zelda in front of the huge red buoy that marked the southernmost point of the USA. Then I headed north out of town. Now it was official. I had begun my journey from one end of the road to the other. I was happy to finally be on my way, but images of people sleeping in the street and Papa Hemingway blowing his brains out drifted in and out of my mind. Who was I to think that I'd ever become a successful writer? And why the hell did I want to drive an antique truck clear across the continent? I meandered north towards Grassy Key, and all along the waterfront I saw ragtag fleets of decrepit boats moored together. Most of them hadn't been under sail for years, but it was obvious that folks were living in these floating compounds. I imagined a tired and neglected Zelda sitting on blocks in a wheat field in Montana. I could see myself all alone with long hair and a beard and ranting and raving about how unfair life had been. Sometimes an imagination can be more of a curse than a blessing. I turned into the Jolly Roger campground, and the families and retirees were a welcome sight. An attractive young couple was camped next to me, and they brought over some freshly broiled snapper for dinner. We sat on Zelda's back porch and listened to calypso music while the sun settled on paradise. The young mother was friendly and talkative, and she told me about the fantasy life she once lived while working in a Colorado ski resort. She watched her children run around Zelda while laughing and waving sparklers under the 4th of July moon. Then she looked me straight in the eye and said, "I don't miss the fantasy one bit." Living the life of a compulsive addictive wanderer seldom bothers me. However, her comment caused me to wonder. Someday, my choices would come back to haunt me. But fortunately, before my imagination got away from me again, a couple of young campers strolled down the boardwalk and interrupted my thoughts. They had bought one of my demo tapes the night before, and one of them asked if I'd autograph it. "Hey, mister, I want your autograph, just in case you get famous someday." "Sure," I said as I grabbed a pen. "You like the tape?" "Yeah, especially that song about paradise," he said. "How'd you come up with that idea?" Any storyteller will confirm that most of their tales are merely products of their imagination based on life experiences. Several years ago, I dated a free-spirited young lady who I'll call Jessie. We jetted out of Colorado one blustery winter day, bound for the Virgin Islands, looking forward to a week of scuba diving. Jessie and I got along famously, as long as we were under the water or under the sheets. But as soon as we came up for air, we fought like angry sharks and did our best to make fish food out of each other's heart. End of a very short story. Another year I escaped the islands by myself for some relaxation and adventure. One night I found myself at a party on a yacht in Great Cruz Bay, where I met a blonde-haired beauty from Miami named Jennifer. Although we had just met, Jennifer and I were getting along so well that someone mistook us for newlyweds. That is, until one of the crewmen on the yacht slipped her a vial of white powder. Jennifer and the Puerto Rican sailor soon disappeared over the railing and into the water. End of another very short story. And so much for long-term relationships. Rather than brooding over the folly of my misadventure, I combined the ingredients of both experiences and stirred in a little fiction for flavor and wrote a song called "Going Through Hell and Paradise." It was a wonderful wedding, a beautiful sight. I was handsome and black, she was lovely and white. I said I will and I do, and I'll always love you. She said she'd honor and cherish and always be true. But now I'm going through hell and paradise. The sun is so warm, but I feel like ice. It's 100 degrees in the shade of this tree, but I swear that my heart is fixin' to freeze. Well, I guess by now that it's plain to see, happily ever after didn't happen to me. After autographing the demo tape for the fisherman on the boardwalk, I tossed out my half-finished beer, pushed a worn-out Buffett tape into my homemade sound system, and dozed off to sleep to the bittersweet melodies of a son of a son of a sailor man. I woke up the next morning to the sound of a plane buzzing overhead. I looked out Zelda's window and saw a small man pointing skyward and yelling, "The plane! The plane!" I rubbed my eyes and looked again, just in time to see a monstrous seaplane landing on the water and taxiing over to the shore. There was a wedding on the beach, and damned if I wasn't the groom. I was wearing a tux jacket, no shirt, cut-off Wranglers and boots. Jimmy Buffett crawled out of the groom in albatross and walked up the beach wearing a tropical print shirt with a white collar. He was a preacher in pirate's clothing. At the same time, Ricardo Montalban drove up the beach in a baby blue Cordoba. Mr. Montalban climbed out of his Cordoba and escorted several of my former lovers to the altar. The pirate preacher was waiting to perform the wedding, but I couldn't make up my mind which of the ladies I wanted to marry. While everyone was waiting for me to decide, Ricardo took one of the beautiful ladies down to the water, and they swam off in their birthday suits and left me there in the sand in my cowboy boots. Of course, that's when I decided she was the one I probably should have married, but I wasn't sure. Then I realized I was stranded on Fantasy Island, until I woke up. I rolled out of bed and splashed cold water in my face to wash away the nightmare. I pushed the images out of my mind and started planning my day. I was anxious to get down the road, but first I had to fix the wiring in Zelda's dash. I like building mechanical things from scratch, but I never claimed to be a mechanic, and I especially hate sorting out someone else's not-so-handy handiwork. The wiring in modern vehicles are coated with numbers or colored wires, but Zelda had neither. After 43 years of mechanical molestations, Zelda's wiring left considerable to be desired. Wires that were red at the switch were spliced with yellow wires that were spliced again with brown wires before reaching the accessory, which made tracing wires a real nightmare. With considerable anxiety, I lay on my back and wedged my substantial body between the steering column and the twin shift levers. I began cutting melted wires and trying to maintain a mental image of where they belonged. Then, to further add to the confusion, Looky-Loos came out of nowhere and started asking questions about Zelda. "Hey, pretty sharp rig!" "Thanks," I muttered while trying to concentrate. "Now, let's see, black 14-gauge to marker low. What year is this thing?" 1953, I grumbled. Maybe that was yellow 12-gauge to... "What you doing under the dash?" "Trying to rewire my lights." "Oh, I hate doing that kind of stuff." "I don't care much for it myself." Before I left Colorado, I had promised to keep in touch with my friends, and since I was semi-retired, reaching out and touching someone via AT&T was out of the question. Furthermore, I had promised myself that I would learn to write. The notion that a truck driver, with limited education and no background in journalism or literature, could climb out of a truck, sit down at a typewriter, and write a book was stretching reality a bit. Therefore, my solution to both problems was to write letters home every week. If I wrote a personal letter to everyone, it would take at least 87 hours a week and would be more work than driving a truck. And since I can't seem to tell the same story twice and have either version remotely resemble the other, I was afraid that friends might compare notes and discover that I was lying half the time. Then they might get confused and think that I was becoming a politician. Therefore, I decided to write newsletters, but don't let the term newsletter mislead you, because I seldom send any news. In order to ease this task, my sister donated a laptop computer to the cause. One of the inherent problems of using a word processor is that it's far too easy to obliterate a line and start over, which I did hundreds, if not thousands, of times. Back in the dark ages of typewriters, entire forests were decimated because of writers who typed two words, then ripped the page from the roller and hurled those ill-chosen words into a nearby receptacle. Another problem I have with computers is that I am a certified technophobe. I don't hate technology. I just hate not knowing anything about it. After all, I'm the sort of guy who's intimidated by the wiring in a 1953 Peterbilt. While obsessing on this technophobia thing, I might as well get something else off my chest. Maybe it's just me, but no matter what quantity of electronic gadgetry I've got, there's always some other gadget I've got to get before I can achieve computer nirvana. I'm reminded of the slickster who sold me my first personal computer. He had the hypnotic charm of a TV evangelist as he so eloquently assured me that I would reach new heights of awareness with an NXS 286 Super Deluxe TurboTech computer. I could take it home, plug it in a nanosecond, I could balance my checkbook and make grocery lists. I redefined the term frustration as I plotted through DOS on the 286, but my checkbook still isn't balanced, and I don't even make grocery lists. But who cares? It doesn't take a spreadsheet to go to the grocery store and come back with a jug of milk, a box of cereal, and a six-pack. The guy who sold me my second computer was an indignant twerp who rattled off specs faster than a dot matrix printer. Surely I was the only baby boomer alive that didn't understand computer ease. He sold me a computer that had everything but the kitchen sink, although it did have Windows. After reaching a moderate level of competence on that computer, I decided to take my dog and pony show on the road. That meant that I needed a computer that ran on 12 volts, 110 volts, or diesel. Damn, those diesel computers are hard to find anymore. Therefore, I had to plug an inverter into a converter so that I could divert enough power to the computer. Even with all of this gadgetry at my disposal, I still couldn't print my letters because I didn't have a printer, which meant I had to retype the letters on my trusty old typewriter. When I designed the desktop workstation in Zelda, I had envisioned pages of literary treasure spread forth among award-winning photographs, just waiting to be picked up by National Geographic. Unfortunately, National Geographic never called, but I did manage to write 22 newsletters from the seat of Zelda the Pete, which evolved into Straight from the Road. I love to drive. I'm a driving machine, and it was a beautiful day to motor up Highway 1, so I pulled out of Grassy Key and headed towards Miami. I was kicked back in Zelda's air ride seat and listening to the steady rumble of her 6-inch straight stacks as she rolled effortlessly along. Zelda's tires were keeping a steady rhythm on the concrete bridges that stretched from key to key. Thump, 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 thump. There wasn't a single cloud in the endless blue sky that merged on the horizon with the turquoise waters of the Gulf of Mexico. Small fishing boats passed under the bridges and zipped across the glassy surface of the water, leaving arrow-shaped wakes that seemed to point the way to a bountiful day of fishing. When the highway department built the new bridges that connect the islands, they left major sections of the old bridge intact to be used as fishing piers. I looked down at the old highway below and imagined Papa Hemingway rolling south in a big sedan. The big automobiles of yesteryear that once roared along the bridges were replaced by rows of fishermen perched on the railing. Their poles were propped up at 45-degree angles to the sky, and their fishing lines were stretched at right angles into the translucent water. Most of the anglers leaned lazily on the guardrails and stared down into the water while keeping a watchful eye on the seagulls and pelicans that were waiting for a chance to steal away with their bait. Kids chased up and down the broken concrete surface, while well-oiled mothers clad in bikini tops and walking shorts sat in folding chairs and sipped iced tea. Their mothering eyes peered from under broad straw hats and patiently surveyed the action, or lack thereof. I've never understood why people get bored with driving. Even though the windshield is a never-ending motion picture, some people can drive clear across the country and never see a thing. I was in the midst of a premium drive day until I reached Plantation Key and wheeled Zelda into a way station. Zelda is registered as a motorhome and not required to stop at ports of entry, but at a glance, she still looks just like a big old black truck. I reasoned that sometimes it was easier to roll through the scale and let them have a closer look rather than have an angry port officer call out the highway patrol. I don't know if it is this sort of logic or a perverse sense of humor that caused me to exit onto the scale, but I did, and the scale master came out to look Zelda over. He raised his cap off his forehead, squinted his eyes against the reflection of sunlight on Zelda's black paint, and said, "What the hell is this thing?" "It's a Peterbago," I joked. "A what?" "It's half Peterbilt and half motorhome." "A motorhome," he whined. "The hell you say? What all you got in this thing?" "Everything including the kitchen sink," I laughed, then added, "I've even got my Harley." "Well, I'll be dipped," he said. "Where are y'all headed?"
"Alaska."
"Alaska? Why the hell you want to drive all the way to Alaska?" "Well, 'cause it's there and I'm here, I guess." "Well, I expect you must be half crazy." "Well, I expect you must be half right." Well, I ain't got no jurisdiction over a rig like this, he said, so you might as well get on out of here. He stared and smiled as he walked back toward the building, where he was met by another officer. The second officer appeared to be a captain of some sort, and he wasn't smiling. Officer Obi hitched up his heavy leather gun belt and marched toward Zelda. What are you hauling? He said sternly as his eyes darted over Zelda. Just a Harley. Well, actually, the Harley isn't in here right now. Make up your mind. Are you hauling something or not? Well, no, I loaned the Harley to a friend. I've just got a few personal things. What other things? Well, sink and a stove and a couch and a guitar and a typewriter. Pull it over to the side and get your papers. In the trucking business, your papers include a large volume of permits and registrations for every state that you run in, plus authority to operate, proof of insurance, bills of lading, medical cards, driver certification cards, commercial driver's license, log books, and a host of other things, one of which you are invariably certain not to find. Welcome to Ticket City. I climbed down out of Zelda with nothing more than a registration slip and my driver's license. I met Officer Obi at the rear of Zelda, handed him my papers, pulled up the door, and prayed. Well, I'll be damned, he said. His tone mellowed, and his sharp, commander-like movements became more fluid as his eyes rolled back and forth over Zelda's oak cabinets and enormous sound system. Did you build this? He raised an eyebrow. Yes, sir. Why? I don't know. I guess because I'm half crazy, I grinned. This thing is too cool, he said. Officer Obi had completely lost his drill sergeant persona until his eyes came to rest on the row of demo tapes stacked on the shelves. Then his tone shifted back to drill sergeant mode. What are those? He snapped. Demo tapes of some songs I wrote. He studied it for a minute, then said, You wrote these? Yes, sir. Well, what kind of music? Well, it's mostly country with a little bit of rock and a whole lot of roll. He nodded his head in approval. I like the old stuff myself. Hank and Merle and George. Of course, I like a little rock and roll now and then. Every country boy needs a little rock and roll, I said. I heard that, he agreed. Ever write any songs for anybody famous? No, sir, not yet. I'm also writing a book. A writer, huh? Yes, sir. What the hell else do you do? Before I could answer, he fired another question. How can you run around the country without a job? I wasn't sure if he was interrogating me or trying to figure out how he could do the same. Well, for one thing, I sell these demo tapes, and I sell caps and t-shirts, too. These are for sale, he said, patting the tape against the palm of his left hand. His demeanor shifted again. That means you're engaged in the transportation of commercial goods for distribution. Damn, I thought to myself. I've said too much now. Well, it's more of a hobby, I said cautiously. It's still considered transportation of commercial goods. How much does this rig weigh? 21,000. That's a fine of 5 cents a pound for every pound over 10,000 pounds. He calculated in his head. 11,000 times 5 cents, that's $550, he said, staring at me with a deadpan look. Neither of us said anything. $550 was some pretty serious cash, considering that my life savings had dwindled back down to $537.32. And that had to get me all the way to Alaska. Finally, he slapped the tape again and said, Alaska, huh? His eyes betrayed his thoughts as he stared at Zelda. I thought he was going to ask if he could come along. And you say you're just a writer, huh? Yes, sir. Well, it sure doesn't look like you're doing the state of Florida any harm, he said. Then he shook his finger in my face. You get on out of here, and if any of them rednecks up north give you any crap, you have them call me and I'll straighten them out. He handed me his card, spun around on his heel, and marched back to the scale house.
Please fast forward to side B.